I think the process seems really fair, and the new Marijuana Control Board will set fair regulations.
The road to developing statewide marijuana regulations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 29th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a strong earthquake shakes the Alaska Peninsula.
I understand there were some rock slides and stuff falling off the shelves and breaking, and definitely rattled everybody's nerves.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state has a year until it begins issuing licenses for businesses selling recreational marijuana. Between now and then, the Alcoholic Beverages Control Board is home to a new body developing regulations. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the new rules taking shape are modeled on commercial alcohol sales, with regulators hoping to learn from past mistakes made by other states.
ABC Board Director Cynthia Franklin spoke to members of the Anchorage Assembly and a packed conference room this week. She expects rules about growing, selling, and managing marijuana to be done by November and anticipates lots of local control.
The reason is that as a state board, as a small, all-volunteer board, there's really no way for the board to know what's going on in the community. So the community needs to take it to their local government level, and then the local government level weigh in on the license. It's the only way to really make it work.
Communities have the ability to opt out of commercial sales altogether, similar to local option laws banning liquor stores or bars. But for towns and municipalities that opt for commercial ventures, the business requirements will be modeled on alcohol. Franklin, however, wants to make sure that the excesses of the alcohol industry in Alaska aren't replicated with marijuana.
Bar licenses in Anchorage, for instance, are selling as much as $275,000, $350,000.
The board's first draft of regulations places limits on license transfers. It also gives municipalities control of how many licenses they want to make available in the community. And it makes the permit application system merit-based rather than a lottery system. The idea is to keep bad operators out of the market. You can also expect to see industry regulations that'll determine which marijuana is legitimate for sale and what's illegal if regulators find it on shelves. This is what's known as trackability, testing strains of cannabis to make sure it's up to par with state standards. Assemblymember Amy Domboski attended a recent convention in Anchorage for marijuana businesses and was impressed to see software that can track product from seed to sale. But she says that fear of sanction shouldn't be the only thing keeping potential businesses honest.
So if there is a bad actor, it would be very helpful for the industry to self-police and help that not be the face of their industry.
So far, Domboski's impressed with how comprehensive and responsive the ABC Board's regulatory process has been, incorporating assembly feedback and public input. That's also true for Teresa Collins, who owns a local business hosting events that are marijuana-friendly.
I think the process seems really fair, and the new Marijuana Control Board will set fair regulations. And I think that, as it was mentioned, it's really important for people that are going into the industry to get involved and talk and comment. They need public comment on what they want to see the regulations be. So I think that's really important at this point.
The next meeting on regulations for the Marijuana Control Board is in July, followed by a 30-day public commenting period. For more information, you can visit the ABC Board's website, where the draft regulations are posted. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Just a day after two federal lawsuits involving the Pebble Mine were in the news, mine opponents today are hailing the Alaska Supreme Court's decision on two state cases. The justices unanimously overturned a 2011 ruling in a case that challenged whether the DNR permits issued for exploratory work at the Pebble site should have included some public notice. The plaintiffs, including Nunumta Aliyukstai, Vic Fisher, and former First Lady Bella Hammond, argued that DNR was essentially disposing of public lands when it permitted the drilling of more than 1,000 holes and dozens of seismic blast lines as Pebble explored the deposit north of Lake Iliamna. An Anchorage Superior Court judge ruled in favor of the state of Alaska and Pebble, which had joined the suit. The plaintiffs appealed to the Supreme Court, which reversed the 2011 ruling. The second case, linked to the first, involved the matter of collecting legal fees after a lawsuit. After the first case was ruled on in 2011, Pebble and the state of Alaska sought costs and attorney fees of nearly $1 million from the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs argued that they had brought a non-frivolous constitutional claim and didn't have sufficient economic motive for doing so. The Supreme Court justices unanimously agreed. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority has delayed action on the state agency's proposed purchase of Fairbanks Natural Gas parent company, Pentex. The AIDEA board announced the delay following an executive session in Anchorage Wednesday. As KUIC's Dan Bross reports, the session followed numerous public comments that were critical of the deal.
The Pentex Fairbanks Natural Gas utility purchase is aimed at forwarding the state-led Interior Energy Project to bring low-cost natural gas to Fairbanks. The overall project has general public support, but its viability and timeline drew questions at the AIDEA meeting. Most of the public commenters urged the agency to refocus on the alternate option of shipping in low-cost propane from Canada. Commercial property owner Pamela Troop emphasized the fuel's portability.
Available to everybody immediately.
Another commenter, Delta Junction wind energy producer Mike Kraft, pointed to the lack of a sufficient natural gas supply and FNG's currently limited local gas distribution system.
The solution that this presents is only going to affect basically about 5% of the people in Fairbanks at this point in time.
AIDEA is helping finance FNG and Borough Interior Gas Utility expansion of distribution piping, but broader use of the clean-burning fuel is expected to still be years out. Too slow for residents like Jimmy Fox, who also voiced support for propane as an alternative to wood heating that fouls wintertime air.
I have a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old that go to school in one of the heavily polluted areas of Fairbanks. And we need relief right now.
The AIDEA board did not respond to public comments, but is considering propane as part of an RFP process. A statement from AIDEA spokesman Karsten Rodvik says the corporation remains positive about progress and continues to work to bring affordable energy to Fairbanks. The AIDEA board can take up resolutions related to the Pentex purchase with 5 days public notice or at its next scheduled meeting in Fairbanks, June 25th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a high school grad in juvenile detention works to turn his life around.
After this, there's no coming back to JYC. It's to the big boy house, and I don't really want that to happen to me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
There were no tsunami warnings, but last night's 6.4 magnitude earthquake northeast of the Chignecks rattled residents all over southwest Alaska. The quake happened at 11 p.m. sharp. Alvin Peterson in Chignik Lagoon says it's the strongest earthquake he's felt in decades.
It was almost comparable to the 64 earthquake. The house was rocking pretty good. I understand there were some rock slides and stuff falling off the shelves and breaking, and definitely rattled everybody's nerves.
The quake was initially reported as a 6.8 magnitude, but was later downgraded. Residents all around the region took to Facebook last night to discuss the earthquake and its effects. Many of those commenting said the earthquake's unusually long duration was a bit shocking. Closer to the coast, residents in Chignik Bay headed for the tsunami shelter last night to be on the safe side. Fire Chief Guy Ashby, speaking this morning, says the quake got a slow, rolling start.
Well, it started off kind of like maybe a 3, just shook a little bit, and then you can start hearing it building and start shaking a little harder and kept building. It probably shook, with a rough estimate, 35, 40 seconds.
The quake happened at a depth of 35 miles. It was felt as far to the west as Platinum and as far to the east as Wasilla. A recent study linked obesity in children to domestic violence. Now, evidence indicates that childhood trauma can spur physical disease later on when an abused child reaches adulthood. In Alaska, the state is working to reduce adverse childhood experiences to lessen the latent impacts of trauma and to help reduce the burden on social services programs. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The conference room at a downtown Anchorage convention hall is abuzz with chatter in anticipation of keynote speaker Linda Chamberlain. And Chamberlain has a strong message.
Our early emotional experiences do become part of the architecture, the foundation of our brains. Our brains are incredibly plastic during childhood, but don't forget, as I talk about this, that till the day you die, your brain is plastic.
The event, a symposium hosted by the State Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, took place earlier this year. Chamberlain told the audience that adverse childhood experiences, such as witnessing drug use and domestic violence, can stunt a child's neurological development.
The younger the child, the more vulnerable the brain is. The thing is that you will go into a shelter, a domestic violence shelter, and I will see babies with PTSD. I know it right away. They're avoiding eye contact. They're frozen, inhibited.
The good news, she says, is that with effort, negative brain wiring can be changed. Chamberlain bases her comments on the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACEs, which was conducted through the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente during the late 1990s. Researchers found strong links between childhood traumas and long-term health and economic outcomes.
This is true of people who've ever been diagnosed with depression, people who have asthma, obesity. The negative outcomes are just more likely in the group with high ACE scores.
That's Patrick Sidmore, a planner with the Alaska Mental Health Board and a member of the State Advisory Board on Alcohol and Drug Abuse.
For example, for current smoking, we estimate from our Alaska data that 32% of the people who are current smokers would not be smokers if we could eliminate all adverse childhood experiences. And that translates into about $185 million of savings to the state, not necessarily state government, but across the public and private sector.
Sidmore says data gathered by the Alaska Division of Public Health during 2013 shows how childhood trauma contributes to chronic disease. For example, 30% of asthma sufferers in the state have links to ACEs, and almost half of COPD patients have high ACEs scores. Since it is more cost-effective in human terms to prevent childhood trauma than to pay for the damage later on, social service providers are seeking ways in which to do that. Communities in several locations in Alaska are working on becoming trauma-informed. Elizabeth Ripley is CEO of the Matanuska-Susitna Health Foundation.
Since the ACEs study was released, the brain science has caught up to the science behind the ACEs study to show that it literally trauma changes the very physiology of the brain. But the good news, as Linda Chamberlain shares, is that we can heal the brain, but we have to be intentional about it.
Ripley says MATSU has 8 personnel trained in how to inform the public in schools, in law enforcement, and in business on efforts to reframe how we deal with childhood trauma, especially in schools where children who act out are often misunderstood.
We've tended to ask, what's wrong with you? And this changes the framework to what happened to you.
Ripley says a cohort of Alaskans have worked with the original authors of the ACEs study to train 25 people from around the state to help by providing information about the prevalence and impacts of child trauma.
The information about the fact that people can heal and that we can build resilience and help people heal from the trauma and have brighter futures is really incredibly revelatory to most people.
She says creating resilience is the key, and that just informing the public and private sectors that touch children is a huge part of the effort. MATSU joins Homer and a half dozen Alaska communities now working to become trauma-informed. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Today is John Pugh's last day as Chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast. He's retiring after almost three decades with the college. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, Pugh leaves a legacy of being much more than a chancellor to students. He was a teacher, an advisor, and a friend.
Valerie Davidson was 19 when she met John Pugh. She was interning for the Alaska Legislature and studying elementary education at UAS. He was her college advisor.
As many 19-year-olds are, I had these grand visions of how I was going to change the world. And what I so appreciated about John was he enthusiastically accepted all of my grand visions of the world, but helped me to establish more realistic timelines.
Davidson is commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, a position Pugh formerly held. When she was appointed, Davidson and Pugh saw each other at a governor's reception and they reconnected. She says he continues to be her advisor.
You know, there are just times in your life when you meet people who are there at exactly the right time, exactly the right place, and for exactly the right reason. And I was very fortunate because I got not only one of those experiences with John, but I got two at times in my life that were really critical decision points for me.
Pugh arrived in Juneau in 1978 to work for the health department. Afterward, he worked briefly as a legislative staffer before joining UAS in June of 1987 to help with the budget. By fall, Pugh was a dean of arts and sciences. Since then, the number of full-time students has grown from 300 to more than 800. Several facilities, like the Egan Library and residential housing, have been built on the Juneau campus. Pugh was also part of the 1987 reorganization to integrate what was then Ketchikan Community College and Sitka Community College into campuses of UAS. Pugh says that was a hard transition.
We worked constantly getting to Sitka and Ketchikan and making sure they felt a part of this. And I'd say it took a good 10 years to get to where there was a real comfort level of trust.
Ketchikan campus director Priscilla Schulte has been at the school for 35 years, back when it was a community college. She says Pugh has done a great job of being inclusive.
We get the feeling that he understands our community. He has always kept us in mind so that when issues came up, he was always, what does Ketchikan think?
Pugh was appointed chancellor in 1999. He says his biggest challenge was making sure UAS got enough funding to be a quality institution, with UAS getting less than 10% of the entire University of Alaska budget. Pugh says it was never about competing with the bigger schools for resources.
We're not UAF. We're not UAA. We're UAS. What is it that we can do? What can we do for our region? What can we do for the state?
Pugh became Chancellor Emeritus at the recent UAS commencement ceremony. He says that means he'll have a permanent connection to the college. He doesn't see the rank as just a title, but as a responsibility. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Kwong. This week on AK, a teenager and his past. It's graduation season for Alaska high school seniors. Earning a diploma marks a milestone in a person's life. And for one Juneau student, that milestone is especially sweet after his high school experience was interrupted with several trips to juvenile detention. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on finding a fresh start in an unexpected place.
At the Johnson Youth Center in Juneau, a handful of students are mixing, blending, and whisking their way through culinary class. It's not easy stuff.
See how you're doing your whole arm?
For Jay, an 18-year-old finishing his first year here, learning how to make creme brulee was a big moment.
It tastes like heaven, but in a custard way. One time here, we try to torch the top to get that hard crust, but we set off the fire alarm here.
We're not releasing Jay's full name because, as a juvenile, his criminal record is confidential. Although Jay's graduating soon with his high school diploma, he still has another year left at JYC. The center houses juveniles for both the long and short term.
You know, coming here is like, I thought like my life was over. I'm like, wow, what am I gonna do now? Like being in here like got me all these activities and all these like classes and certificates that's gonna help me in the real world.
Jay fell in love with culinary class pretty soon after coming to the center. Chef and teacher David Moorhead says cooking teaches the kids focus and managing expectations. Some have felony charges and are court-ordered to spend 2 years locked up at JYC.
I think this place can be really heavy on the kids, and this kind of gives them a little outlet. So for some of them, it's like the best thing since apple pie, to be able to come here and just kind of break away from the regimentation and learn something new.
I put the water in a separate container and under the faucet.
When he was in regular high school, Jay says he caved to peer pressure. He's not comfortable detailing the crime that landed him here. But he says he made a lot of poor decisions.
I made a lot of mistakes over and over again.
Now he lives in the treatment wing, which is separate from short-term detention. Staff don't refer to him as an inmate. He's a resident, and the facility isn't called a jail. Some of the kids on the treatment wing, like Jay, are repeat offenders who were in and out of the system until the court appointed a longer stay.
When you go through his file and you see how many times that he has come to visit us, and you say, huh, what point didn't you get it?
Julia Black is a teacher's aide here. She says it took some time, but eventually Jay started to come around.
He all of a sudden woke up. Watching him buckle down and get to school, and every day I would go down and I'd see him, and you'd just see this kid that was doing everything he could to do it right.
In part, Jay says his wake-up call came after being sentenced to 2 years at the center.
2 years of your life taken away, and after this, there's no coming back to JYC, it's to the big boy house, and I don't really want that to happen to me. And there's a lot of people that are counting on me, I don't want to let them down.
One of the people counting on him is his infant son. He had to miss the birth while he was serving his sentence.
It's a really big disappointment in my life. I was like, I don't want to go through this again, and I don't want to put my son through this. I just want to be there in his life when I'm out of here and like stay in there.
JYC offers counseling on being a good parent, dealing with stress, and building healthy relationships. Jay says during his time at the center, he's learned a lot about himself, and he wants people to know he's not the same kid from day one.
I'm not going to be that punk kid anymore that didn't care what other people think and didn't really care about anything, and like deep down inside, like I do care. I'm not going to have my mistakes define who I am today. I'm just going to move past that.
In a year or less, Jay will be back out in the world. He's the first in his family to earn a high school diploma. And he says, yeah, he's a little anxious about what the future will bring.
You know, I came here not really having like much responsibilities except for going to school, but now I'm out here, I have to hold a job, take care of my son, and like live on my own. Now, it gets me nervous, but not as nervous because I really know that I can do it.
Now, if we wanted to further refine
with his work readiness training from JYC, Jay says he's looking at careers in the culinary arts or mining. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're talking with Chef Amanda Cash, who owns a new food trailer in Anchorage called The Magpie that specializes in making breakfast and lunch with local ingredients.
We're in a trailer, Waymatic trailer, from Fulton, Kentucky. It was made in 1980. It's fantastic. It's 22 feet long. This is such a fun way to be able to cook, to do local food, and to be able to travel, and to be able to go into neighborhoods and create a sense of community by going to people instead of them coming to me, and also to be able to spend time with my family. by setting my own hours and locations. I have all the equipment that I would have at a normal restaurant. I really do. I'm set up very well in here. I have a convection oven, I have a flat top, I have burners, and I have a fryer. I haven't fired the fryer up yet, but eventually I might. Before, I was working a 23-acre organic farm and growing my own produce in Indiana, and then was able to come up here and not really finding that scene so much, but it's starting to really take off. And I think that the community is appreciating it more. I love to go berry picking up near Cantwell and on the Denali Highway in August. It's one of my favorite things. And I just have memories every summer of my son and friends out berry picking and just watching him grow up through the photographs out in the tundra. And it's been really wonderful. And I love that we can go out in our backyards and get food. We can get fish, we can get berries, we can get medicinal plants. And it's just all around us here. I've always liked magpies. I always liked shiny things, and I collect things and bring things back to my nest. And that's kind of the same as a magpie. And then my nickname has been Magpie Sue over the years. And so I decided it just all fit.
Amanda Cash owns a bright yellow food trailer called The Magpie in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Elizabeth Jenkins, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter @APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Alan Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.